is the Day Zero update for January 13th, 2019. I'm Fleetwood Alpha.
I'm Patrick Mifflin.
I'm Brennan Park.
I'm Chris Elogi.
I'm Jennifer Victoria.
I'm Ryan Schlemmer.
And I'm Lee Lamb.
So it's CES week, or at least it was. There was a lot of very interesting gaming announcements coming out of there. Yeah, what can I say about that show? It's slowly becoming a lot more relevant to us than it is to most of the other tech press. So, yeah, we'll be talking at length about that in a little bit. Before we get to that, though, yeah, we've been playing some stuff. There have been some betas and demos that have shown up, and I'm sure some of us have been checking them out. As for myself, well, let's see. Yeah, the Dead or Alive 6 demo sort of...
yes.
Yeah, it's dropped on the PSN a couple of nights back, and I've been playing that. And I got through two online matches before I pre-ordered. It was just like, yeah,
yep.
That's going to happen. Usually I don't ever do that. And yeah, that game made just such an incredibly strong impression to me. It's like, okay, they actually know what the hell they're doing.
And now you know how I felt coming out of Evo.
Yeah.
Because I played the shit out of it there.
Yeah, it really is. It's like this, it feels like DOA, and yet it also feels like a real fighting game at the same time. So, yeah, I know the DOA fanboys are probably going to get on me, but DOA was always a real fighting game. No, yeah, guys, you were trying to get there, but now you've gotten there. It is good for everybody, especially when, movement now actually means something.
Yes.
Yeah. So that
they've basically gone full Soul Calibur with it, and it feels fantastic.
Yeah, yep. It's like you ran into this too, and it's like, Ayane's drill kick does not track anymore.
Nope, I sidestepped it just not because I stepped at the right time, but because I was in a state of lateral movement.
Yeah.
When the other player threw it out, and that's how it should be.
Yeah. So yeah, this is a game that's going to be taking up a lot of my time, I suspect. So yeah.
Oh yes.
So I've been doing that. I've been doing my usual Tetris effect every night. Hit level 70. I'm still working my way through. Probably the more levels you get, naturally, the more experience it takes to get to the next level. So mm-hmm. Yeah, it's you have to play a lot to get to level 100. Fortunately, that's with the XP boosts that they do during rituals on the weekend, you can kind of offset that a little bit. But yeah, it's still a great game. I want DLC for it. So,
do we know that 100 is the cap, or
it looks like 100 is the cap?
Okay.
Yeah. So there's that. And I've also been apart from that putting together a Raspberry Pi 3 with all of the bells and whistles and getting the RetroPie going. Getting that set up is fairly straightforward if all you want to do is just drop ROMs on it and play. If you want to get a little bit more fancy and start adding art and metadata and all that stuff to your front end, then it gets a little bit more involved. I will say though that the Pi 3 plays PlayStation games using the same emulator as the PlayStation Classic and does it better. So, yeah, nice job, Sony. But yeah, I'll just say that for the most part, the Pi 3 is actually quite good. Just forget about N64. It can kind of do it, but it's not really happy about it. So, yeah, I wouldn't play that on there.
So Wave Race will bring it to its knees.
Yeah, basically. It's like, it's not happy with doing 3D on that level. I suspect a lot of that is just because the emulator optimization just isn't there for that particular system. But I'm wondering if that'll ever get there, or if eventually the Pi 4 will come out and just add more brute force, which will just help that anyway.
Yeah.
Which I suspect will probably happen.
That's what my money's on.
Yeah. I mean, there are more powerful single board computers that can run this stuff a lot better than the Pi can, but none of them are as cheap as the Pi. So, yeah, it's a nice project. I'm enjoying doing it. I love that it's completely silent while I'm playing, so that's pretty good. Looking at getting maybe an NES or PlayStation themed case for it. That'll probably be fun. Apart from that, that's pretty much been it. How about you, Pat?
I too have been on the DOA 6 beta. First chance for me to play this game since Evo, and so I had to jump all over it. Everything about this game just feels right. I can't stress that enough. I'm still a little unclear about certain aspects of the system that don't seem to quite have context just yet. Those, I guess, break combos or whatever, their fatal rush, something like that.
Yeah, it's like I noticed that they do the tutorial there. They just kind of goes, this is what does what, and it doesn't ever actually let you go back in to experiment.
It just seems a little too good for a freebie, but maybe time will tell that there's some other drawback to it. I noticed they were blockable, so that's good, but you have to spend meter to get out of them.
Yeah.
So I don't know. That just seems a little dicey to me, but we'll see. Other than that, I've been playing Stormblood because I've fully relapsed on my Final Fantasy XIV addiction. And, oh my god, this game is in such a good place right now. Usually the last two patches before an expansion drops are amazing, and this one is no different. In this one, we've basically been sort of poking our heads into Garlemald occasionally and seeing what's going on there. And we find out that a certain character from A Realm Reborn is alive and well and ready to gut some Asians. So that's an interesting direction.
Hold it. What did you just say?
What?
Gut some Asians. Did I hear that right?
Asians are the characters that are sort of pulling the strings behind everything going on in Final Fantasy 14.
Interesting name.
And they made a powerful enemy who survived the events of pre-patch A Realm Reborn. And this is going in a really interesting direction. Meanwhile, you find out that Varys is not the potential ally that the 4.5 trailer made him look like. And in a sense, they've made him into a villain for every Final Fantasy game. Because when you find out when you figure out what his motives are, he's still very much a villain. And basically what he wants to do is sacrifice the other worlds in order to perfect Eorzea, the world of 14. So that makes me wonder if we're going to be visiting the other worlds when Shadowbringers drops this summer. That could get really interesting. And I played some Pure Pool. I've finally been doing some 8-ball after spending my entire time with the game playing 9-ball up to that point. I don't know. 8-ball just seems too honest to me. You have to run the table entirely, whereas with 9-ball, you're always just one sneaky plant shot away from victory. But I'm having fun. Other than that, I'm still working on planning out my Tales streams. I'm down to two games for consideration, and that's Tales of Symphonia and Tales of Zestiria. And that's mainly just because if I can do this on the PS4, I would prefer to. But I can understand why Symphonia is the game that several people have tried nudging me toward for this. So we'll see what I end up doing. But that's been my gaming for the week.
Hey, Patrick. For Final Fantasy 14, I was going to ask you, that's like in that category of games that's like I'm sort of interested in, but I haven't started. What I mean by a category of games, it's like online game. Is it too far along? Like, can somebody just jump in at this
point? Oh, no. No. It does have its multiplayer aspect, but the fact of the matter is, just think of it as a as a Final Fantasy game that they're constantly building new content onto. So it's an ongoing storyline rather than a self-contained one. But the patch content is usually small enough that that you can get through it fairly quickly. And if you're just playing through from level 1 to 70, or soon enough 1 to 80, yes, it will take you some time, but it's really no different than if you were to get into, say, the Trails of series and started with Trails in the Sky and had all these other games to play through. In fact, I would say that Trails is still longer than where we're at in Final Fantasy 14 right now. So just think of it as a really long Final Fantasy epic.
Yeah.
And it's one of the best stories that the Final Fantasy series has produced in years, to be completely honest. One of the best casts of characters, too.
Yeah, it is. And I frankly can't stand MMOs, but even I love Final Fantasy XIV. So.
Yeah, it's weird because for the most part, I mean, there are exceptions to this, but a lot of the content you can kind of experience on your own. And you don't really have to deal with too many people.
Yeah,
it's when you get into there's the larger...
There's a token dungeon run here and there, but the duty finder makes it really easy, and I just set it up so that I can go into any language game and then pretend I don't speak any of them.
Yeah.
So, I literally do a bow emote when I start and finish the run, and I never touch the keyboard other than that during the entire raid. So
yeah.
Yeah, you can get out of that really easy if you want to know things about boss strategies or anything. Mr. Happy does a lot of really good ones. Mistech on YouTube does a lot of really good ones. So you can definitely do your homework on dungeons so you don't have to talk to anyone.
Yeah, but so my turn now, I guess. Smash Brothers still. Still playing that. God, there's so much content in that game. Doing Rocksmith, like I've mentioned that some time ago. I got that, so I've been, learning to play guitar, and I kind of ran into the same issues I had back when I was first starting to learn to play guitar, which is my fat sausage eagle claw fingers that, sometimes make it difficult to press down all the strings on the neck. But other than that, it's really good. If you're really thinking of learning to play the instrument, I highly recommend it because it makes it very simple. You can do it at your own pace. It's not pretentious or anything. They focus on each individual parts of playing the guitar, from everything from simple picking to hammer-ons, chords, pretty good stuff. I finished up Just Cause 4 the other day, the Just Cause series is a good example of how you don't really need a good story in order to make an incredibly awesome game.
That's true.
Because Just Cause 4's stories are always the most cliched, sort of generic bullshit, but they're just so damn fun. It's just they embrace the insane, over-the-top action trope where, physics don't really matter. this guy, you can get cars and all kinds of vehicles and stuff in Just Cause 4, but I'll be completely honest, for the majority of it, when I was traversing the game, I barely used any of them unless I had to. Most of the time, I just either caught a ride from a drop-off point and then basically used, the grappling hook and the sky suit, basically. Because of the way the slingshot effect works in that game, you can pretty much traverse several miles just, gliding on with the sky suit. It's a lot of fun. And other than that, I also did the Resident Evil 2, the one-shot demo. And I'll go into more detail on that later on when we get to the picks of the week. But just to put it in short, if you get a chance and can go ahead and do it now. Because, man, it's a lot of fun. I mean, it's like how many of us have played the original Resident Evil 2?
No, I can't remember. Most of us.
I wasn't very into it.
I mean, that's something
I didn't enjoy it, but I played it.
Yeah. Imagine the sort of overall story and structure of Resident Evil 2 with, you know, modern up-to-date graphics, and the gameplay is the gameplay mechanics are more a bit like Resident Evil 4. Hmm. But I'll go into more detail in it later on. That's pretty much what I've been playing. So what about you, Chris?
Yeah, so I have been playing a couple games that I have on my Twitch app through the Twitch Prime stuff. One of them is The Messenger, mm-hmm. Which I think they put up on there around New Year's at this big Devolver Digital, I think, pack. And finally got it working because obviously not being on Steam, it doesn't have the wide-ranging controller support that Steam does. So it just works with an Xbox controller. And since I don't use that, I had to pull back my install of DS4 Windows, figure out where I left that, and get that going so I could actually use it. And once I did that, it plays really well. It's a game that is inspired by the original Ninja Gaiden.
Mm-hmm.
Very much in style, though. It's very much like a comedic take on it. Because your character is kind of the guy at the ninja school that is the slacker who doesn't really understand. They're like the protectors of the earth against this eventual demon invasion that's going to happen. He doesn't really believe it's actually going to happen. They're kind of just wasting their time doing all this. And then, surprise, it hits, kills all of his fellow ninjas. Now he's the one that has to save the world. By taking this message to whatever place you're supposed to go. So you are the messenger, essentially. And yeah, it plays pretty well. They have a neat mechanic where if you hit an enemy, a projectile, or these specific lanterns that are around the level, you can do a second jump if you're in midair. So it kind of fits the double jump mechanic into combat in a really cool way that leads into some really cool action moments and platforming moments where you are kind of just getting in the rhythm and being able to just get around pretty cool ways. It looks really nice. It has a really good soundtrack, at least so far from what I've played. That kind of reminds me of Shovel Knight's soundtrack a bit. And yeah, there's some upgrades you get. It has a really cool kind of death mechanic to it, where when you die, you are kind of resurrected by this guy named Corbel, who follows around, and as you collect the crystal shards that you use as currency, he will take them until he gets enough, or you take long enough to. So if you just wait around, he'll just get bored and just leave. And yeah, it's a pretty cool game. I'm looking forward to get to the twist itself, but I've beaten the first two bosses. And yeah, it's one of those games that if you're into kind of retro style games, that's definitely one that people should check out. I think it's only on PC and Switch right now. I assume it'll come to PS4 and Xbox One at some point.
Yeah, I hope so.
Also on the Twitch app I was playing is Guild of Dungeoneering. And it is it's kind of a pretty cool, it's kind of like D&D, it's kind of a roguelike D&D, I guess, where you are managing this guild of dungeon explorers, and you sort of go into these dungeons with them, and you're kind of building out the dungeon itself. As you get cards, it'll include different rooms you can add. And there's a whole part of that that is just they have different paths through them, so you're lining them up, but also placing enemies and loot around to guide your dungeon explorer, because you're not directly controlling them. So you want to put the loot, or sometimes they'll have different perks to them, like the first guy is attracted to fountains. So if you lay down places with fountains in them, he'll go straight for them. But along the way, you get into fights, which are turn-based, and also use cards for that stuff. But it's kind of like a turn-based RPG, where you get cards like, oh, you do 2 hits here of damage, and the enemies will also use their own cards. And so you kind of play around with it in a way of like, oh, they're going to attack, so I'll use this card I have that has a shield that blocks it. But then as you progress further in the dungeons, you get more cards, more different types of attacks and such, as you get like loot that you can attach to your character. And it's not permanent, it's just for that dungeon, but it's a pretty cool little game. By the end of this second dungeon I was doing, I had played a ton of cards, so every time I go into a battle, I have like a stack of like 30 cards to go through, but it's a pretty fun little card RPG thing, and it's definitely one of those smaller games that, if you're into that kind of thing, it's definitely something you should check out on PC. I guess also on Steam. But yeah, that's been pretty much it. How about you, Danreb?
I was playing the Spyro trilogy, and I finished the first one, platinum bit. I liked it a lot. It does have some camera issues and things like that, and the collectathon really reminded me of how much I enjoyed Banjo-Kazooie back in the day. And I'm surprised I never got a chance to enjoy Spyro before. And then I was looking at old videos of the original game, and I was like, man, this game is ugly. No wonder I was never into it. So it being remastered definitely helped out. I don't know if I'll be jumping into Spyro 2 anytime soon, especially with my big backlog. But at work, I've been playing Super Smash Brothers with the co-workers, some Tetris Effect and Astro Bot with the VR, because that's the only place I have room to play VR. And I plan on starting Minute today. Minute is an indie game that's pretty much been released on everything. And it's a pretty interesting concept. It looks like a 2D Zelda game, except that it's more of a puzzler in the sense where you have to solve these puzzles and explore in 1 minute intervals, because you die every minute. So I'm looking forward to this. And that's pretty much it. What about you, Ryan?
Well, I've been playing some more retro games. The reason is really, and we'll talk about this in a bit, but I've been testing out some controllers. So I just recently, actually, I picked up Sonic Winter Adventures from a guy on Instagram. Goes by Toy Source Games, but I'm sure you can get it anywhere. But it's just kind of it's like a hack or homebrew or something. I'm not even sure what to classify it as, but it's like the original Sonic 2-3 game, but it's all winter, and you've got some different abilities that you can do, and you know, it's just kind of a fun theme for that. So I've been playing that on the Genesis, and then I've been playing the Saturn, and Sega Rally Championship is just
yes,
a fun game to play. Yes, so I've been testing that out. Really, that's it. I haven't had a lot of time to really get into anything deep, so I've just been playing on those couple of consoles and testing out some controllers. So,
yeah, we'll have to talk a little bit more about those controllers in a bit, because mm-hmm. I am very interested.
Yep.
I guess that's what's about you, Lee?
Pretty simple. I played Gunpoint. It was about 3 hours. I loved it. I wish I'd played it years ago, but I had a compatibility issue with my old PC. Super fun. Music's great. Really cool, like old school graphics. It made me really wish there was a new elevator action out, actually. So did that. I just picked up Tales of, is it Vesperia on the Switch? Whatever the one that came out. Got like 5 minutes into it and then got distracted with some other stuff, but I'm going to go back to it probably tomorrow. And then I've just been playing a while with my wife, so pretty normal stuff.
All right. I thought about picking up Tales of Vesperia, but $50.
Yeah, I got it. I got it for like $30, just because I got in with something with Amazon. But yeah, you know, it's a Tales game. It'll drop to like $20 in 4 months.
Yeah. Flash sale.
Yep.
Not the Switch one. Yeah.
Yeah. Switch
PS4.
Yeah. Yeah, Switch games tend to retain their value for some reason. But, yeah. So I guess that's about it. And so let's get into the news. We're going to start with the biggest story of the week, probably, apart from CES, was the news that Activision and Bungie are parting ways.
Yep.
Yeah, so they've Bungie announced on their website that they're splitting up. The Destiny IP remains with Bungie. They're going to get to continue working on that. Interestingly, apparently Bungie got an infusion from NetEase. That is a little bit worrying for me. If you remember, NetEase is the Chinese developer that likes to do all of those clone mobile games and is working with Blizzard on Diablo Immortal.
Yep.
So I'm not sure if they maybe have, you know, switched one crappy partner for another. But apparently this is a deal to develop a new IP for NetEase. So it looks like it might just be contract work and not a partnership or NetEase buying into Bungie. So we can hope. I think for the most part, this is probably good news for everybody involved, except Activision, who seems to be having some issues right now. Yeah, looks like they're being investigated for securities fraud.
Well, I should point out that that announcement came from a law firm that is... They're one of those law firms that like to sort of scrounge around for potential investors for potential loss, class action lawsuits whenever a stock drops a point. So it's possible that it's just them trying to get clients. Yeah. But considering this is Activision, I also don't want to completely discount it either.
No, I don't think I'd discount it either. I mean, we got this is the company run by Bobby Kotick, and as we know, he is the spawn of Satan. So, yeah, I'm not really sure what you guys think about this. Is an independent Bungie would an independent Bungie convince you to go back to Destiny 2 or try it
well,
to begin with?
No. No, I think that the damage is done. So when you build these types of gameplay systems and gameplay loops, and I know Pat knows what I'm talking about because he plays MMOs, and I'm watching WoW deal with it as well. Once you have that pipeline set in place, and your game is designed a fundamental way, it's very, very difficult to reverse that. You can look even when it's just like pulling out systems or readjusting them. That kind of stuff can take a long time. Look at what happened with Diablo 3. I mean, it took them like a year and a half to rip out the auction house and really kind of get that game to play the way that it was supposed to. WoW is currently having a huge problem with its gearing system that is fundamental to the way that the game functions with the Battle for Azeroth expansion. So they just are having a horrible time trying to actually readjust that so they can make their players happy. So I think what the most interesting thing to me about the whole Activision thing is that they're letting Destiny go. And to me, that says that they don't think Destiny actually has any value.
The thing is, that's not their property.
No,
this
it doesn't.
Is always a Bungie property.
Right.
This is
Halo, though. And they left it with Microsoft.
Well, that was owned by Microsoft.
Right. They paid money. They basically helped fund it, which is what Activision did with Bungie. And
yeah, but it was always an independent project. That was sort of their whole deal. It was a 10-year deal publishing. And that would end next year, 2020.
Right. And they cut it off early. Which, yeah. Again, signals to me that they don't feel like Destiny has any value with the way that they want to do business.
And they're not leaving any money on the table for the next year.
I think it's they could not find a way to purchase it from Bungie. Because they say in this announcement that Bungie or Activision has an increased focus on their owned IP projects. So that makes it seem like Activision wanted to go to the next step with Bungie and Bungie's rebuking wanting to keep their independent status to a degree, and they were given an option to, you know, back out completely, which is good for Bungie. It's nice to see that this sort of happening a bit more with studios like we saw with IO Interactive, who are able to, without like a sale lined up from Square Enix, they were willing to sort of take a buyout from the owners of IO and sort of let them have Hitman and maybe Freedom Fighters. And so, yeah, this, I actually am kind of excited for Bungie for this, to be able to find a new path forward versus the sort of the expansion heavy release schedule they've had for this series for the last 5 years, whatever it's been, and not having to necessarily try and start over again for each new game. Maybe find a better way to release, because like they're doing right now the annual pass stuff for Destiny 2, which is releasing new content on a weekly basis versus doing these bigger expansions that doesn't really seem to satisfy the players, and it doesn't really seem to do much of what Bungie wants to do with the game as far as like evolving it over time. And that's kind of been the big issue with Destiny 2 for like the first years. The two expansion packs, like, okay, you can play this for a couple days, and then after that, unless it comes with something substantial that the players really like, it's going to essentially end in another like down period for players that aren't just playing it every day. Hmm. And it seems like with the most recent expansion, like, that has added a lot more new stuff to do every day or every week that has kept people coming back. And like they had a whole like puzzle thing that was going on for the next upcoming bit of content, which ended with players getting stalled in such a way that I think Bungie just ended up just releasing it outright because yeah. Players are getting stalled. And some weird puzzle stuff, like people having to know like French poetry in a weird way and sort of figuring out, oh, there's a French guild in the game, so you have to stand on their sigil and then shoot at these trees because the poetry has to do with trees. I think people weren't putting those together, which also resulted in people harassing Bungie employees on Twitter because it wasn't available as soon as they wanted it.
Well,
so
I'm not sure I'd fault Bungie for that. I'd fault players for being kind of dumb.
I think Bungie just overestimated how much work it would take to do this stuff.
Mm. Yeah, it's
figured
true.
Somebody would probably be like, "Oh, maybe this."
Mm. They're taking that from what WoW is doing. WoW has this huge thing in the game right now where they put a whole bunch of secrets in there. There's actually a secrets Discord, and it's one of the only things that's actually keeping people engaged.
Yeah,
is doing like these breadcrumb type riddles and shit that are in the game, and then like at the end, it ends up giving you a mount or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and kind of the interesting thing is, like, what's going to happen with the PC version, because that's in Battle.net.
Yep.
And so it's like, okay, is that going to be pushed out? How's Blizzard going to handle the people that purchase that on their accounts? Is there going to be a general Bungie.net account system? Which they already have the accounts, but as far as, like, purchases going through that stuff, and are they going to move that to Steam, or maybe Epic jumps in? It's like, oh, hey, here's $20 million. Let's do this.
Yeah, I think Epic probably would be probably shoo-in to pick this up.
Yeah,
it'll come out.
I think I'm different than you guys. I think that this is. I think Destiny is kind of like fundamentally poisoned, and I think that even with an injection of NetEase's money, with the way that NetEase makes their money, that whatever Bungie puts out is going to have the same transactional problems that Destiny 1 and 2 had to like the nth degree, because NetEase doesn't make money by waiting.
Yeah, but the NetEase money is not for Destiny. No, that probably will be.
No, I know. But whatever. Even if they did, let's say if they did Destiny 3, or they fundamentally changed how Destiny 2 works, that's not going to give NetEase their return on investment. So if they produce something new based on with that injection of cash, like, you don't, at this point, Bungie's an independent studio again. And you don't give an independent studio like that money unless you're also actually going to tell them how to partially create the product and how you're going to get your money back.
Yeah.
So, honestly, all we can really do right now is wait and see.
I mean, we can speculate, but there's it's one of those things where we don't know the details of the agreements. The NetEase, from what I read, the infusion of cash was to create an IP specifically for them.
Mm-hmm.
So that doesn't have anything to do with Destiny 2. So we don't know.
Yeah.
I will say that, for me, any company getting away from Activision is an automatic win.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
I mean, it's obviously Destiny, the very first Destiny especially, even though it made money, let's be honest, for most people it was a disappointment, at least at first, because it had so much built that they were doing building up for it, like, all the stuff that they said we were going to be able to do, and then we got the game.
Yeah, it didn't have any of that.
No, it was basically... that's the point where you really start to ask, like, is this all really Bungie's fault, or was it Activision? Did Activision, were they the ones that stepped in and said, look, we're going to be distributing this thing, you guys got to play by our rules, and they're the ones who tore huge sections of the game out and then sort of cordoned it off for paid DLC?
Yeah, I think
that's part of it. I mean, way that Activision does business is that's fundamentally part of their business model. And if you've, I'm sure you guys have read all the stuff that's been coming out with Bungie over the years, and then with Blizzard, and then the Activision stuff as a whole. Like, they're the CFO that they brought in, I think it was last year. The whole point that they brought her in for was to cut costs. And so she actually just left. I can't remember which company that she went with, but it's really interesting that, like, fundamentally, with Activision Blizzard, there have been, like, truly fundamental changes to the way that they actually produce content over the last couple of years. And the most interesting part for me about the whole thing with Bungie is that if Activision thought they could make any money and they had a year left on their contract, they would have stuck it out, but they didn't. And so to me, that tells me, just based on my own experiences, that Activision cut losses because they didn't see any more money that was viably able to be made by continuing with what they were doing in Bungie. And so that also typically means that you're having engagement metrics that are down. And then the cost analysis that you're looking at, when you're like, okay, if we have these engagement metrics and this engagement brings us X amount of dollars, if they don't have that, Activision is going to be super quick to be like, okay, this isn't working for us. And then if they cut off Bungie at that point, then they're not having to pay payroll. They're not having to do anything that would actually be a fixed sunk cost that they couldn't make back. That's the most interesting part about it for me, because if there was any money to be made, they would have stuck around for another year.
Now,
tried to renew a contract.
Yeah, now let me ask you this, since you're the guy who knows the more business end of it. How much of that is Bungie's fault, and how much of that is Activision's fault?
Oh, I would actually say this stuff goes hand in hand. So when you produce a product like that, and if you do it top down, like, there's a couple of things that are readily apparent when you see the way that Destiny was deployed, and along with the way that Destiny 2 was deployed. A lot of it, when you see those decisions about, like, for instance, we'll take Destiny. I remember when it first released, everybody just basically complained that there was, or for Destiny 2, that it was just RNG, 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 right? And then you had really simple complaints that people had, like, I think it was with the shaders. Being like one-time use, but being an absurd amount of money. So when you deal in this kind of space where the identity is tied to your character and customization matters, when you try to actually milk that kind of money out of people, it actually really creates a severe backlash. Those kinds of ideas don't come from developers. They come strictly from corporate. So even if Activision, like, didn't have people that were standing over Bungie and going, you are going to make these decisions, what they most definitely had is a framework in place for the type of engagement that they wanted, and then the type of results in terms of monetary results they were expecting from that level of engagement. And what you typically will see in development like this is that if you have those types of engagement numbers and then you can't figure out how to make money from that engagement, you slap on a microtransaction. And then that's where you see, like, the stuff with shaders and everything else comes from. And that comes from management either being held to a contract. So, like, in this case, Bungie's management basically being told that if you have this amount of customers, we expect to have this amount of money coming in. They have to figure out how to make that. And if there's a continuing process on the actual – or not process. I'm a little scatterbrained today. If there is a section in the contract that basically explains they expect a set amount of money per month from that engagement, the only way that you can do that, if people stop buying the box copies of the game, is to get more people in there in hopes that they spend money. That's one of the reasons, like, when we talked about it a few months ago, when they were basically giving the game away for free, it was because they were hoping that people would then buy the expansion, which would just start getting more money rolling in the door. So Activision definitely set that tenet to Bungie, and it was most likely set up when they signed their contract. And I think it's readily apparent looking back at it now, when you see the way that Destiny 1 was handled and the way that Destiny 2 was handled, was that Bungie I think fundamentally did not know how to hit those engagement and money metrics with the way that they designed their game. They just didn't know how to do it. And
well, I mean, is it just possible also that between the time that they signed that contract and the time Destiny came out, that there was just a fundamental change in the gaming market? Because, I mean, because remember, when they went to Destiny, they had just come off of Halo. And
right, they were the big FPS dick.
Yeah, but Halo, and Halo was massive hits, and, I played Halo as well, but Halo back then represented a gaming market that was fundamentally different to what it is now. Because
different from Call of Duty that Activision had at that time.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think originally when they were getting Destiny, the idea is that, like, okay, here's another an MMO-style game that we can bring in that can constantly drive that engagement and be a supplement, as opposed to, like, we're not selling map packs, we're selling content, But the thing is when you do stuff like that, the pipeline to create that content is really, really difficult, particularly if you're a company like Bungie or anybody else that has, like, a high pedigree. People associate quality with your name. Like, you guys, over the last few shows, when we've mentioned NetEase, we talk about how shitty they are. Mm-hmm. But if you talk about somebody like Bungie or Nintendo or Blizzard or anybody else like that, there's a level of quality that you expect when you're actually playing or playing one of their games or buying one of their products. And so I think that's the other thing that you looked at. There was a fundamental problem for Bungie is that – so in development, and then I'll leave this here. There's a lot of different ways that you can develop things, right? But one of the ways that – and a lot of developers are moving towards this is something called Agile. And it's one of the reasons that we see a lot of early access games now. What it is in Agile development, you basically build a square, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you make the square very thin. And so basically what you're doing is you're building the skeleton of what it is that you actually want to create. And then you iterate and iterate and iterate and iterate. So you're basically kind of building the shell outward or from the inside out, right? Until you get a complete thing that you're trying to do. And the reason that you do that is because if you fuck something up in the middle of it, right? Like, let's say you just develop something that just doesn't work. You haven't expended a ton of resources by actually chasing after whatever it is that you were doing. It allows you to be agile and then pivot and then start building again and kind of iterating on something else. What a lot of developers have had the problems with the last, I'd say, two generations, and we saw it with a lot of these studio closures that happened, is they weren't really doing anything that's based in agile development. What they were doing is they had their roadmap, and they said, here's all the things that we want to accomplish, and this is the way that we're going to accomplish them. And then they go away for 5 years, and then they finally produce a game. And that game may or may not be, at that point, what's something that the market even wants to buy anymore. Epic is really, really good at agile development with the way that they deal with Fortnite and the way that they produce content, because they basically have all these little modules built out and they slam them all together, and that's how they put out all their updates. A company like Bungie doesn't work that way, and actually Blizzard doesn't work that way either. They have a roadmap of, okay, here's what we're going to do. This is the way that we want to do it, and then we're going to go away for 2 years and see what we produce. And I think that one of the things that we're seeing with just development in general is that I don't know that you can keep making games like that unless you have a lot of money. And that's the reason why this, them cutting, Activision cutting Bungie loose early is so interesting to me, because it is fundamentally based around what kind of money can be made and what type of outlaying of money you need to do to actually make the money that you're expecting from the actual process. And it seems like, again, because you don't cut a deal like that and then cut somebody loose a year early, unless you're just like, there's nothing to be made here, we're going to start losing money. So I think that I think overall, the way that Activision wants to build games and the way that a lot of their studios are building games are fundamentally incompatible. And I think that's the bigger problem that you see. Like, that's why they have mobile developers and everything else like that they're looking at. That's why even with companies like Blizzard, you see them going towards somebody like NetEase, because NetEase does agile development. They just basically copy something and then they iterate the fuck out of it. Like, another good example of somebody that doesn't do agile development well is Nintendo. Look how long it took, and Nintendo and their partners, look at how long it took for Pokemon Go just to get PvP battles, something that's fundamental to Pokemon since, what, 1994? Mm-hmm. It took them like 2 years to do that. That's because the way that they wrote out their spec for what they were going to build said, okay, we'll add this at some point, but they never ever said, okay, here's the way that we're building this and how do we incorporate it? They thought about it after the fact. So I think the overall thing that you're going to see with Bungie going forward is, I think you'll see a new IP, and I think you'll see either a fundamental recreation of Destiny 2, and then they'll just keep iterating on Destiny 2 rather than ever fully putting out a Destiny 3, or they will do a Destiny 3 that kind of wipes the board and lets them start over again and try to rebuild that audience. But I think that they're also going to run into the problem that WoW has now, and that I think a good chunk of their audience is gone, because you don't give away a game for free if your audience is still engaged.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah, I think for me, it kind of feels like Activision looks at it as like, we have these guys for about 2 more years. And should we invest more money into this versus, you know, Call of Duty, I guess Spyro and Crash, they also have, or Blizzard stuff like that, they have control of for the foreseeable future. And it almost kind of feels like sports a little bit, where teams look at players for how many years they have them under control. And when it starts to get to the end of that contract, then they're not like, oh, we're going to sign them for a bigger deal for a long term. They look at ways to flip them for new deals, new players that are under longer control, and sort of keep the sort of shell game going on for a while with, as far as like Activision goes, with these sort of shorter term, you know, temporary deals, because they're not going to buy Bungie at this point. They weren't up front either.
Yeah, I think,
so I think they're looking at this like this money from, you know, Destiny. We're looking at only 2 more years of it, so why should we continue investing into this thing? Because it seems like they probably figured out pretty early on, like, Bungie's probably not going to re-up, and they're not going to accept an acquisition. So,
and I think that also goes along with – you have to look at the reasons why they wouldn't re-up, and that also has to do with that there's something fundamental in the deal that's not working for either party. And I'd imagine Bungie's point of view, it is in the same way that they rebelled against my, I mean, look, if you saw the, you guys see the pictures and stuff from when they announced that they were splitting from Activision, people were popping bottles in their break room. And so you, like, you don't do that if everything that, you know, the deal that you have and everything is great. You're not like celebrating like you just, like, you know, ended slavery or something. Yeah. And they're over there like partying like it's 1999. And again, you're not doing that unless there's a fundamental issue there. Like, you guys completely disagree about how the way you should run your business. Yeah. So I think that's important. I think the other thing too, that Activision has some kind of fundamental problem going on, because they, like, I don't know if you guys, like, I pay attention a lot to pricing for games that I'll never buy, but I still take a look at it. And pretty much ever since it launched, the latest Call of Duty is $30. When was the last time you guys saw that happen?
Yeah, it's never happened with the Call of Duty games.
Never.
But also, those Call of Duty games are the top sellers. I think we saw the NPD guys put out, like, here's the top selling games for the lifetime of the PS4 and Xbox One. And those Call of Duty games are like the top three.
Yeah, and, but see, when you look at the way that they've built their business model is that it used to just be the box copy, and then the map packs were $15. Now they're 50. Yeah. And so they're doing that because they're trying to extract that money. But if you're, again, if you're going back to putting, even if they're still the top sellers overall, that doesn't mean that the latest one is actually selling what they expect it to do, because you would never see a Call of Duty game drop to $30 the month that it launched.
Yeah, so but I think they also look at the Black Ops Pass and the microtransactions, like, okay, we can take a loss here on the base game as long as we get them in and get them on this Black Ops.
Right, but they've also been in cost-cutting mode for the last year and a half. So losing money on the front end doesn't make sense when it doesn't guarantee you that you're going to get a sale. Like, I'm telling you guys, there's something fundamentally going on with the accounting over there that they're having a problem with. Because even as big as Activision is, you don't lose money up front if you don't think you can recoup it. And I don't think them discounting the games is happening because they're like, we want to sell them a battle pass.
Yeah, well, they're also selling like a specific version of that game on BlizzardNet that's $30 that doesn't have the zombie stuff in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's them trying to get more people in. And I think they're seeing that less people are buying the season pass thing, because they're pretty much the only big IP out there that's still holding on to that thing. Whereas everybody else has moved on to,
I think Fortnite's beating their ass. I think that's the biggest reason that they're changing.
That too. Yeah. But I also think they're doing really well with it compared to what people thought. You know, when they announced, like, oh, we're doing Black Ops 4 and there's going to be, you know, a battle royale thing in it, people are like, oh, people are very hesitant about it before they got a chance to play it and see that it actually turned out pretty well.
Well, yeah, I think the other thing is, you can look at it, and Brandon, I'll shut up and you can talk. But I think the other thing too is that they've been doing this annually for 14 years.
Yeah, they have.
You know?
Yeah, this is like,
they should have known that this gravy train was going to stop eventually. And
I think they found a potential new life for the series. Because the last few years has been kind of like, oh, let's go back to World War II, because maybe that's the thing that will re-energize people. And it seems like this Blackout mode is kind of re-energized people.
I know the future-based games apparently never sold as well as they expected. No. Like there was something I was reading about that from one of their investor calls where they talked about that. So
Black Ops 1 and 2 did really well. Those are like some of the best-selling Call of Duty games.
Yeah, when they put them back on, I know when they put Black Ops, I think it was 1, when they put that back on backwards compatibility, it shot up to like the number one played game on Xbox Live. So
yeah, but that's because Black Ops 1 and 2 are fundamentally great games.
Well, yeah. Yeah, well, and that's the thing. You're hearkening back to a time where they weren't jamming microtransactions into every hole of the corpse of the game that they were playing. So yeah. I think the overall thing here is that you're seeing – I think Activision is trying to figure out how they're going to be doing business for the next 10 years.
Yeah. Because
you start cutting those costs, and you don't make that kind of decision unless you are anticipating a downturn. Because the one thing that happens with all of these companies, which is really kind of counterproductive, is that the first thing that happens when anybody's thinking that they're going to encounter some serious financial troubles is they cut payroll, which is ironic because the people that are on the payroll are the reason that they're actually able to continue doing business. But that's the first thing that you see them start doing is start cutting people that they feel aren't essential and trying to narrow down that payroll because you're anticipating a downturn. And so I think that's, not to get into the weeds of that stuff too, but I mean, that's also dealing with economic conditions that are happening in the country and the world as a whole. Like everybody's stating that we'll probably hit some sort of a recession in late 2019 or 2020. And so these companies are going to try and batten down those hatches ahead of time because they see it coming.
Yeah.
All right.
All right, so yeah, we'll follow this as the story develops, as they say. Not really much left to say. I think we pretty much covered everything there.
Yeah,
if you want to see something that really did not age well, I saw people pull up shots from Call of Duty: Advanced Warfare, which has Kevin Spacey in it. There's a bit where he's talking about a junior high school.
Oh yeah. Lord!
Oh dear! Yeah.
Yeah, we're not going to touch that one with a 10-foot pole. So. Nope.
I think the problem is Kevin Spacey was touching it. Oh!
No. Oh, who went there?
Like, oh, that's a really great junior high over there.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a new meaning now.
Yeah.
Right, moving us on before we get pulled off of iTunes.
Yeah.
Anyways, so CES happened this week. Ryan here was there. I think you actually went in the original capacity for CES as as a retailer looking for stuff to actually get into your store. So that was
Ryan, tell us about the future.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'll just start with Retrobit. That was the first appointment that I had. And so I was there day one, actually when the doors opened. When you walked in, they had a much larger footprint than they did last year. I would say their floor space was probably double what it was last year, and they were showing a lot. To get into their booth, you kind of walk through it was like a faux movie theater arcade complete with the movie theater carpet and everything, with arcade machines against the wall, and they were all displaying their Super Retrocade, which is one of those systems that's got a bunch of licensed games on them from Capcom and Data East and Jalico and stuff like that. But they had them in full stand-up arcades. So a lot of people are asking about that, are they going to do something with that, or was that just for show? They didn't really expand on that, but you could play, Mega Man in a stand-up arcade, for example, Mega Man 2. And then once you get through there, you get into the real kind of announcements kind of area where they had stuff on display. In the first section, they had their Hori inspired controllers. I think they're calling them they're calling them something that says inspired. In other words, tribute controllers. And I got to play with those. So they had they have wireless and wired, and they have USB, which is Switch compatible. So we were playing Smash on the Switch with a Retrobit Hori style controller. Very cool how that worked. And the other item that they had that was kind of oddly in that section was something that's going to be a bit of ways off, and that's their Nomad, Sega Nomad console.
Yes.
that was just a very early, I think they're just showing intent, really. I don't even think the one that was on display was exactly playable, or if it was, they weren't playing them or showing that. But really cool. They, you know, it's going to have an upgraded screen, obviously, and battery life. That's kind of the jokes with regards to the original. So
six double A's, 12 minutes.
And it had controller ports on the bottom, which I didn't take pictures of. I should have. But, you know, the idea is that it's going to connect via HDMI to your display, and you can hook up, you know, controllers to it if you want to play games that way, or you can just take it on the go and play it portable. I asked him about, because the screen does make it look like it's going to be 16:9, and I asked him about that, and the idea is to include aspect ratio, either switch or some sort of software adjustment there where you can just select what you want, so you can have proper just, you know, resolution there. And then once you get past that, you got into kind of what everyone was asking about, which was all of the different controllers. They had controllers complete with dates and everything. So the first wave of them is going to be the wired controllers, which is releasing next month in February for the Genesis and the Saturn. Dreamcast, I'm kind of going off the top of my head. I know Dreamcast wired controllers are coming later this year. And I can't remember if that was spring or summer. But those are coming. They didn't really have anything on display for that, for the Dreamcast controllers. They did have the Knights controller, I think called the 3D controller, Saturn, and that'll be coming out very, you know, along with the other wired controllers. Nice. Different colors, all kinds of different stuff going on there. And as I mentioned, I've been testing these controllers. So I've been testing the sort of the original, well, I guess the six button Genesis controller, and then on the Saturn, I think it's actually the second iteration controller, but it's a bit smaller. And they both, I mean, everything works great, feels great. There's really nothing overall that would tell you, because I do have original ones to compare them to. And I mean, they're almost like you can't tell the difference. So they did a really good job kind of doing that and staying true to the original look and feel, most importantly, the feel of them. So everything feels right, looks right. Sega signed off on it, and that's the other thing. So they have to sign off on all this stuff. And they are more critical than people probably think. They do get involved, and they do have, you know, some people don't realize, or they can kind of minimize what Sega's involvement is on some of these things because they have made some missteps. But this is, you know, important to them, and this is their legacy. So they take this kind of stuff very seriously, and they do get involved with production. They'll just let their name just go out like sometimes I hear people suggest that they do. So
Sega's whole model could be, well, we made some missteps.
And I think that's fair, you know, but that doesn't, I think they're aware of some of that stuff. I mean, we saw what happened when, with their mini console, they essentially just pulled that. No word if that's even going to come at this point.
It's a shame too, because I feel like this would be the great time to have old school Sega back, maybe some Skies of Arcadia and some other stuff. Like this is the market is now ready for the kinds of games that they should, that Sega would make. You know, that's the market is back for that. You know,
yeah, because Sega when it was at its best back in the day was the Sega that was willing to take risks and invest in really crazy stuff that would sometimes pay off really well.
And sometimes you would get semen.
I mean, there's a lot more to come from Sega, and you know, I think they started off pretty good with their Genesis collection. That's great.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the other thing too. So all these USB controllers, like the Genesis one, it is Switch compatible. So if you got that collection, on your Switch, you can play it with these controllers as well.
Nice.
So, you know, so that'd be a good deal. And then as far as games coming out, I mean, things are, you know, talks are happening.
Well, right now, we already have the Shenmue 1 and 2 remakes, and then there's the Panzer Dragoon 1 and 2 coming as well. Right. So, yeah, they seem to be dipping a toe into that, into those waters.
Yeah.
Well, that's exactly right. And things don't always happen as fast as, you know, we as fans want them to. But they are very carefully making sure that everything's happening, you know, as in a way that's going to, you know, be best possible for us as gamers, really. So they're going a little slower, it seems like, but they're trying to take the time to do things right. So, and then, and I mean, just little things like, what they've done with the Shenmue remake, they took a lot of time with that. They didn't just, you know what I mean? Then once we got through that area, we got, into kind of a free play area, but on the other side was, of course, the, new game announcements, as we're just talking about. Retrobit teased a Super Nintendo game coming this year, and they teased an NES game coming this year, yet to be named. The one that they were able to announce is the one that, that we have a part of. Well, if we're going to have a part of all of them, honestly, but is Metal Storm. And we're doing
I was hoping for this one.
Yeah. And a lot of people had mentioned that because, you know, they know that Retrobit's working with IRM, and, you know, that's kind of, we'd already done Holy Diver and R-Type and everything. So Metal Storm was just on a lot of people's lists, and that was certainly on ours. So that's happening. We're going to do a side-by-side release on that with limited run games. We have a meeting next week to kind of go over all the final details. So things that'll be included in the set, price point, all that kind of stuff, release dates. I mean, I have some information that's target, but it's not firm. So we'll be announcing all that stuff next week. And all I can tell you really is there will be two different versions, one that you can get through us and one that you can get through limited run, but they will have differences, superficial differences. The game will be the same. But, you know, things like the color of the cartridge and perhaps some of the included materials, things like that. So that was what I saw there. I did go by Hyperkin's booth as well, and I saw what they had to offer. I played with their, I think they call it the Hyper Blaster Duck Hunt, you know, the gun that's for the NES that's specifically designed to play Duck Hunt on a modern display.
Which is big.
Yeah.
What's that?
Yeah, so you can throw your gun at the TV that will now break when the gun hits it.
When I got to use it, it works exactly as you would think. You know, as it did on a CRT, but you're just playing on a modern, you know, on a, you know, HD TV. Works with an adapter that is affecting the ROM in some way, the timing. And this is all patterned after they're working with. There was a Kickstarter that didn't make it very far last year. I don't know if you guys remember, from a company called Modern Mallard. And they essentially saw the potential there and teamed up with that company to bring the product out, you know, despite it not making it in Kickstarter. The original proposal from that team in the Kickstarter was going to be that you needed to open up your cart and use an adapter, you know, like just like the way we did Gyromite, you know, like when you open this up and you see that it's a Famicom board with a 60 to 72 pin adapter. It would be something akin to that, like a little adapter board to a different PCB that does the same thing. And then you were going to have to open up your zapper and make some changes to that too. That's obviously not as, people want plug and play and just easy. So Hyperkin just made a new gun that had those changes incorporated. And then they made the adapter as a separate piece that plugs in between the game and the console. Which is great, because that also opens the door for, you know, that whatever timing changes, you know, on that adapter is specific to that game, unfortunately. But, you know, I asked him about, you know, other games. Are we going to see other light gun games? And, you know, that would just require a new adapter. So you could buy the gun and the adapter set and potentially, they aren't even working on this yet. So it's not, they're not saying this is happening, but they do want to see this happen is to release another adapter, for example, for Hogan's Alley or something like that. And then you could keep going, to the extent that there's interest in things like that. They had a couple other cool things. They had, their take on a Nintendo 64, updated Nintendo 64 controller. They also had their version of a premium original, the original design, Triton design, of that. So they're coming out with a couple of Nintendo 64 controllers, one that's wireless, and that seems like that's a little further away than we had thought. Their original announcement was talking about late winter. That's not going to happen. But they are working on it. It's going to come out this year. And saw their Game Boy. They had a Game Boy that they had teased last year. It's still in production. And the official answer on that was, quote, "It'll be ready when it's ready." So that was one a lot of people asked me to ask about. And, I mean, it was the same, literally in the same, you know, display case, everything is probably just as far along as it was last year. So that seems to have taken a back seat to some of the other things they've been working on. They had a Pi cartridge adapter for the SNES. So you could play original carts through a Pi Zero. It's kind of interesting. And they're just dabbling in a lot of just different areas, but those were probably the big things I saw from them. And I'll give them credit. Their controllers have been great. Their premium, like their Cadet and their Scout controller, which are the NES and SNES controllers, they're my preferred controller now, over the original. So they're doing a great job, and to see them continue that line, they just released the Genesis controller, which has gotten mixed reviews. Some people like it, some people don't. Feel like maybe they add some like ergonomic bumps to the back that make it fit in your hand a little better, and some people feel like it makes it a little bulkier. I prefer it personally, but I can respect that other people don't. They re-released the Atari controller that's ambidextrous, so it's got two buttons. You can play it left-handed instead of having to play it right-handed. And then now they're coming out with that 64. I think it's great to see. For so long, we've just, third-party controllers have just been absolute garbage, and to see people stepping up with them, I think, you know, we're as a community, as gamers, we're just kind of demanding and expecting more now, and people are stepping up to actually deliver that. It's good.
We've long passed the days of the really crappy PDP controllers that you gave your little brother.
I think, you know, and people are still making, you can still buy the cheap knockoff, just super generic controllers. I mean, you can get those from these same companies, or you can get them from AliExpress for, you know, literally a couple of dollars. And you get what you pay for, and you might get those for specific reasons. Maybe you've got kids that are hard on controllers, or you have a demo unit or something that you're just not trying to put, I don't know, you know, but more of us are really just expecting better. And what I'm starting to see is that these companies are starting to offer these more premium products. I mean, to the extent that some of these controllers are preferred not only by me, but other people as well, over the originals, that's pretty damn exciting, you know? So to see stuff like that, and even these games, so like back to Metal Storm and Holy Diver, these games are being built a lot better too. They're paying a lot more attention to a lot of these games just used to be 3.3 volt flash on, you know, 5 volt bus is incompatible. Well, it's out of spec with the original system, and you're just getting weird. You know, it's just, you open up some of these things and they're just glued together, and you know, that's how they used to make knockoff games or reproduction games years ago, and it's all we had. Now they're, you open up these games and you can see they're taking a lot of time and care to design and engineer them correctly and put together a proper release. I don't think anyone has any real negative complaints about the way Holy Diver came out, for example, and other companies too. So I think Retrotainment Games, they're the guys behind the Haunted Halloween series, for instance, a lot of quality behind that. Just there's a lot of releases coming out that it feels like people are putting a lot of love into these days, and we're getting a more premium product than just something shoveled out to us. And this is where competition has brought out better products for, I think, everybody.
It's crazy to even think that there'd be a time where we'd be like, yeah, that third party controller's pretty good.
Yeah. Back in the day, you were lucky if they didn't fry your controller port.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Like, or your parents came home with that bullshit second controller. You're like, oh no,
shark pad.
They were
just so gimmicky. You know what they were trying to do to offer something different, but it rarely worked or felt right. Now these are actual quality products that are coming out. I did stop by the Arcade 1UP booth as well. That is less had anything to do with me, but I mean, I'm there. I'm going to go see, you know, what they've got going on. I personally am not looking to ship arcade cabinets around the country or the world, but for people who've got retail stores or Walmart or whatever they're selling, it's been cool. It's been interesting to see their price go up, down, up, down, up, down, 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 down. for me as a retailer, that's a little scary, but they did have some cool stuff. They had the Street Fighter II tabletop, which was probably the most exciting one for me personally. They had, so it's basically, you know, it's a tabletop like you'd see in the old, like, restaurants and bars and things like that. You sit down and the arcade game is the table. And then on either side of it, you know, it's the same, it's just dual output to two different screens. And so, you can sit across from your opponent and kind of have that, play it like that. It was really cool. Some of the other games they had, I mean, I'm not sure what I'm exactly excited about, but it's cool to see them growing the line. And I mean, I think they're trying to do a little bit better job. I noticed, all of their cabinets come with, or at least they were showing them with, acrylic over the artwork. So that was rubbing off a little bit on the early models, but I think they're all coming with the clear acrylic now and everything like that. It felt like a little bit more polished, product from those guys.
I think their biggest announcement was probably,
oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think the probably their biggest thing was the sighting of the NBA Jam cabinet that was hanging around there.
Yeah. And, you know, I actually missed that. I went through the area, but it was a bit crowded, and I didn't take the time to actually see every single cab that they had. NBA Jam would be exciting. I'm not sure that they've announced how they're doing the players or what they're doing for there because of, you know, licensing and things like that. But that'd be a good one to grab, and Mortal Kombat, they're coming out with that as well.
Yeah. Mortal Kombat, that one comes with MK1, 2, and Ultimate 3. Mm-hmm. I like the lineups that they've got going. I think, they're trying to improve their quality while also keeping their costs down, which is hard to do with a product like that. They're doing some pretty good work. Bar stools, which is something I didn't expect to see from them, but okay.
Yeah, they had a lot of matching bar stools with the logos of the games that they're kind of releasing.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah.
All around.
So, did you have a chance to look at the Polycade? I know you had you seem to have seen this already at one point.
Yeah. I didn't go by there. I didn't check them out, so I didn't trying to remember what the Polycade was, to be honest.
It's kind of a PC slash arcade cabinet hybrid. It's kind of wall mountable.
Oh, yeah. No, I did see that. And I actually, I talked to those guys actually. That looked really nice. They had two different versions of it, and they were basically, they described that it ran off of Steam. Or they said any game that you play on Steam, you can play on it. It looked nice. That kind of thing doesn't really pertain to me personally, so I didn't spend a whole lot of time, but I did stop and see what they were doing.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the biggest stopper for a lot of people on that one is going to be the price. Yeah, $4,000, but you also have to figure you're getting a very capably spec'd gaming PC inside of that as well.
Yeah.
So this is more of a, you know, going after the PC gamer who wants to have a PC in their game room. So.
Well, and I can tell you just by looking at it and the way I talk to them, this is like the Arcade 1-Up, for example, that's home use only. Pretty much there, and I heard the guys talking to customers or whoever who were interested in putting them in commercial applications, and they said, you know, it's really not designed to that level of use, but the Polycade definitely is, and to the extent that they said that's where they're seeing them put, and a lot of, you know, they're putting them in bars and places like that.
Yeah.
So very well built, probably worth the price. I'm not sure, but it looked really nice. Another thing I saw there that was really expensive along the lines of that, I don't know if you guys saw any of this footage, but they had these, I guess they're like tabletop, you know, cocktail table style Pong games. Did you see those at all?
Yeah, I saw those, yeah.
Yeah, those were really cool. That when you sit down, it's you know, and I guess it all runs off of magnets, but it does. I can see how that would become pretty addicting, or be in a good, you know, spot where you want to keep people sitting for a while. That'd be a good thing to put in. It was fun to play. It was really well built, it seemed like, they did. Whoever was behind that did a great job on that. Again, you know, those were like $3,000. So, for Pong. But they did a good job with it. So,
I wouldn't give a shit if I was a millionaire and owned a tons of businesses. I would never pay $4,000 for Pong.
No. Exactly. I mean, it was cool to play it with. I mean, if you ever get a chance, you see one of those around, give it a shot. But, other than that, I did stop buy some other booths, but it's just boring stuff, cables and things like that we're working on, but nothing really to share, really, that would be anything exciting anyway. I went and looked at some cars too that happened to be in the next hall over, just some of the self-driving cars and things that we're going to start seeing, Kia and Nissan and all that. It's pretty cool world that we're stepping into.
I think from a retro gamer's perspective, one of the coolest things that I can take away from this is that, the retro gaming market is kind of evolving into where you don't really need to hunt down original hardware anymore.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We're seeing new releases of games, and we're also seeing new releases of hardware to play those games on. I'm very interested in getting back into that market because it's like, I would like to get Holy Diver, but I realize I don't have a NES to play it on, so that's a problem.
Yeah, I think the controllers are the gateway. You get the controller right, then the actual hardware itself doesn't matter that much, you know.
Right.
That's the way I'm starting to feel about it now. And I say that as a guy who's got a FrameMeister and all kinds of original crap hooked up. If I could honestly get rid of it and still have an authentic experience, I'd totally do it.
Yeah, I think you can get pretty close with some of these consoles that are coming out. I mean, on the lower end for entry level, you know, you've got things like the Retron HD from Hyperkin. Retrobit has the Trio, which is also an HDMI out console. And These are great. I mean, I think the Retron HD is something like $40. And it has some minor things, you know, where the color palette might be off a little bit here or there. But the reality is, most of us, you know, we're just plugging the game in and playing. You're not typically playing them in a side-by-side scenario with, you know, comparing things, trying to get so picky about that kind of stuff, that for most people, these are great. And what I would recommend, you know, frankly, to somebody who's just getting back in, I actually had our mail carrier comes in when he does our pickups, and he's been mentioning that he's been thinking about getting back into the NES. And I said, all right, well, let me get, you know, I was thinking about getting a front loader cleaned up and I was do a recap on it and do all this stuff. And I started thinking about it. I'm like, man, I'm going to have to charge him, you know, more than he probably is thinking, to get him a real good, solid working NES that I'm going to be able to send off and know that it's not going to have any issues, because some of these old systems can be so finicky, and you really have to know how to take care of them. And then if you're wanting to play them on, you know, an HDTV, you've got a whole other thing. Like you just mentioned the FrameMeister, or you can go into the OSSC or RetroTinker, any of these, you can start working your way into a rabbit hole real quick. And I thought, you know what, I'm just going to recommend the Retron to this guy. He took that home and like five games, you know, I gave him a deal on it anyway, but you know, for a relatively, you know, low price, and he had a blast. Doesn't care. Like you said, the controller feels great. Games work. That's all that most people are looking for. Then you start getting crazy like me, and you start going down and the rabbit hole, start finding, you know, that are premium cables or premium solutions, or you start looking into, you know, zero latency options and things like this for connecting. And to me, that's you should go down that path once you've already kind of confirmed to yourself that this wasn't just a nostalgic, just spur of the moment thing that you felt like you wanted to play Mario 3 again, but you really are kind of getting into the hobby, then pursue stuff like that. But yeah, so for
yeah, otherwise you're paying like drug dealer pricing for this kind of stuff. Yeah. Like, what have I done to myself?
Yeah. I mean, just to get like a good cable, like the ones we sell, from HD Retrovision to go out of your Genesis, that's $60, you know?
Yeah.
So that's just the cable. You know, so for a lot of people, it's, you know, just get that in a couple of games for $60, just get the, you know, and then see, you know, and then if you want to keep going after that, then, to go, you know, as crazy as you want to go. I mean, my setup of course includes all original consoles that have been modified. Most of them are certainly cleaned up and recapped and connected in the best possible way, but not everyone's crazy. Some of us are. Yeah. There's enough of us that are. So, no, it is cool to see companies that are taking the time to put out good solutions, because in the past, some of the solutions just weren't good, and it was tough to recommend things like third-party consoles to get started when they really weren't, you know, up to, you know, at that point, it really wasn't a viable option or something you wanted to suggest, but now they are. And what I saw, what you guys are talking about, what you took away from a retro gamer's perspective, that is also a very small piece of what was shown in the gaming area at CES. Most of it was, crazy VR stuff. And what I mean by crazy is like you're getting into, like I saw something that was just a chunk of a roller coaster, complete with, you know, you sit in the thing and then you bring the bars overhead and they lock you in just like you're getting in one of those roller coasters where your feet hang, you know, and then you put on the headset and this and that, and they have slices of a car that you get into, and it's all VR, and it's just, I don't know where this stuff is going to wind up, theme parks or something, but that's most of what the floor was at CES, was just VR and not anything that you would bring home, but, you know, like commercial application VR. That's most of what I saw there.
Yeah.
Didn't try any of it, but I did last year, but I just didn't want to stand in line, honestly. So,
yeah.
But yeah, that was CES, kind of recap, at least from my perspective.
Yeah, which is pretty cool. And you managed to come back without getting sick, so that was that's a plus.
That's always, yeah. Mm.
Yeah, just hand sanitizer and you know, try to not, like, and that's the thing. If you, you know, if
don't touch anything.
What's that?
Don't touch anything, you're going to die.
Oh, yeah, well, and that's what I mean. Like, you're putting on these headsets and things like that. That's also kind of part of it, you know?
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah, no, I just kind of avoided that, but I did look at it. And it looked interesting. Saw a lot of, what do they call, the TVs. They're not 3D, holographic TVs. I saw some of that stuff. What CES is really is a sneak peek at what's going to be out 4 years from now, you know?
Yeah.
A lot of the cases. You can tell it's early. You can tell it's not quite right in some of the stuff. Some of it's pretty far along. But for the most part, it's like a big concept demo call. So, but
how about Samsung and their 18-foot TV?
Yeah, I saw that. It's something else to stand in front of. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, there are a lot of, you know, they were showing a lot of new TV technology, 8K and stuff like that. I mean, we're far away from that, and I think we're getting to diminishing returns, you know.
Yeah.
Stuff. But they need to, you know, 4K TVs are so inexpensive now that they've got to come up with ways to sell us expensive TVs, you know. And that's
going.
I might be the first new tech I don't jump on. Like, I don't.
I still have trouble telling the difference between 720p and 1080p from most distances.
Sure. Yeah. Well, and it makes me wonder, too, about, you know, like, I've got the Xbox One X. So what's the new Xbox going to do? You know what I mean? Like, what's the. I can't imagine it being a big jump, you know, graphically or anything like that. I mean, it's playing native 4K games already, so I don't
know. Yeah, to some degree. I think the big thing about the next Xbox or next generation of consoles is just going to be 4K consistently.
Yeah.
So
instead of kind of adding things in, or, you know, it's designed from that as a base.
Well, I would still say it probably needs more than that because, you know, seventh gen, the big step forward was HD. Mm. With eighth gen, I don't think that the step forward was so much graphically. Obviously, you could tell the difference between seventh and eighth gen platforms. I think the signature feature of eighth gen platforms was actually its streaming capabilities.
Yeah.
And the ability to turn pretty much any game into a social experience just by streaming it or sharing the content that you record or what have you. I think ninth gen is going to need something like that to hang its hat on.
You're right.
In addition to just 4K.
Like that. But you're right. This current gen is really built around more of that streaming. And, you know, I wonder, you know, like, would games, you know, I'm not as much, I don't know the technical limitations of the gens, but would games like Fortnite have been as successful there? Is that what you're talking about more? Just the ability to connect so many players simultaneously.
In a more hardware-driven sense, I would say the ability to actually stream the content while playing it from the same device rather than having to shoot it through a capture card on a computer or something to that effect. Having that under the hood is a very powerful feature.
Yeah, and social networking you can do with these consoles is actually pretty stunning, actually. Yeah. We talk about the elimination of hardware, and then now what you can do with it is pretty nuts. Because now everybody and their mother's streaming, which you know, I don't think anybody would have thought that had been something 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's what I'm thinking about, is that whatever ninth gen does, it can't just be a graphical or even just a resolution advancement. It has to be, there has to be some tangible element that it can hang its hat on that, that pushes gaming forward.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
we will wait. We'll see what that is.
Yep. Till then, we'll move on to a couple of other news stories that we were seeing this week. These are kind of related because, well, they both feature the Epic Game Store, which we're hearing a lot of lately.
Mm-hmm.
At CES, Ubisoft's The Division 2 is skipping Steam.
Yep.
Going to Uplay and the Epic Game Store.
Yep, that's a big deal right there, because that's basically Ubisoft saying, hey, Steam, you guys suck.
Yeah, I mean, because it started on Steam. Mm-hmm. They've pulled it since. They're still going to honor the people who ordered it on Steam will still get their copy on Steam. So they're not pulling that away for those that already got in. But they decided that Epic was giving them a better deal. So, yeah.
Yeah, and this is after Valve announced the whole increased revenue share for games that sold more, which this would be like one of those games. They're basically like, no, you know what? We're not even going to go exclusive to our own store. We're going to go exclusive to our store and the main Steam competitor.
Epic. Yeah, which is really not exclusive anymore, but that's
yeah, right. But they're okay. Exclusively getting off of Steam, essentially.
Yeah, we're exclusively not on Steam.
Yeah,
yeah.
This is going to be one of those stories that will be interesting to play out through the year.
Yeah, because we're seeing this start to happen a lot now.
Yeah,
Steam is they're starting to lose a lot of face with developers and consumers alike. I mean, I have the client installed, and I only have it installed because I have a gigantic library of games in there.
That you probably don't even play that much.
So, yeah, well, I mean, I have to have it because I want to, you know, if I want to play Defense Grid 1 and 2, that's the only place I can play them on. So I'm kind of stuck with it for those.
The interesting part about this is the Valve could kill the Epic Store in about 3.5 seconds if they just changed how they were actually – what their cut was. Because that's the biggest thing that's making these developers go over. If they could just change their cut, then they would do it. But that would fundamentally also then alter the way that Valve actually does business and what their bottom lines are and things like that. So
also, yeah. It would mean that Valve would have to go back and actually start making games again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, actually – you know, policing the content on their store might not be a bad idea either. Yeah, algorithms, not so great when it comes to finding stuff, as I've discovered.
Well, the other part that really works in Epic's favor at the moment is since the store doesn't have that much on it, you can be a small game and make a big splash. Right now, if you're a small game, even if you're a big one, like I read something the other day where they were talking about even these games that are, you know, coming from developers that are indie, that are basically marquee, like Guacamelee 2 and all that, those games aren't doing that well. And some people said, well, you know, it could be fatigue for the type of game that they are. But I think the other thing that you're looking at, too, is that it's much more difficult to discover these kinds of games because there's now a huge glut of them. And the Epic Store doesn't have that issue. They can just, if you're a game over there, because they don't have that much marquee stuff, you're going to look fantastic, even if you're not that good.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we see this all the time. It started
with Switch.
Exactly.
Yeah.
When you're new, it's very easy to stand out. Yeah. The question is whether the Epic Game Store will be able to ride it out after the Fortnite, after the Fortnite popularity starts to wane a little bit, you know, will people still have the Epic installer, you know, on their systems and see the store that way? Because I think a lot of the popularity that the Epic Game Store is getting is due to the fact that, you know, a lot of people are playing Fortnite and then they can just tab over and go, oh, well, there's these other games here. I can try these too.
Sounds kind of familiar.
Yeah. Yep.
Mm. Yeah. And it's really interesting, especially with the Steam stuff, because even they have things like the recommendation thing where it shoots you like, here's 12 games you might be interested in. But like at the point I'm at where I have enough random stuff on my account that it's just kind of a mishmash, like, I don't know, this thing's popular, maybe? I don't know. And the responses you can have to it are a bit too binary, where it's like, you know, put it on my wish list or ignore it. Or follow it. I don't know what that does.
Yeah.
But it's, I'm like, I don't really want this, but I also don't hate enough to ignore it. Because, like, a lot of it's also on consoles. Like, I'd probably rather have this on console. I guess, yeah. I just skip to the next one? I don't know how that all works.
Yeah.
And it's like, it just might ask me later, hey, maybe you want this now. It's like, I don't... Shut up. Stop.
Yeah. So there's that.
I don't know if you saw the Defense Grid news. They're at least teasing something coming out this week.
Oh, yeah, I know all about that, and I can't talk about
okay.
it.
Okay. Yeah, they're saying, like, for a birthday thing, they got something new to announce.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When, yeah, I can't talk about it.
When you're a big company like Ubisoft, like, I'm a big believer in being available on as many platforms as possible. But what's most impressive to me is the fact that this happened about as close to overnight as possible. I mean, the Epic Game Store is still fairly new, and then it wasn't until the Game Awards that people started taking it seriously. So,
right.
Yeah. It's not even just a cut. It's just, it's really cool, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, and like, you just go to their store, and it's like, here's all the games that are available now and will be available in the future. Because that's all there is. Like, they have What Remains of Edith Finch that's free for right now. Mm-hmm. I think Jackbox Party Pack's coming up in a couple weeks. It's like, the free stuff's neat. The regular stuff, I haven't bought into anything yet, but if they can get the store stuff going and start adding new features and all that to it, they got something that could be certainly a big competitor for Steam, more than just, hey, we just bought the rights to put this on our store.
Yeah, and one of the things that they would need to do is to, you know, get parity feature-wise as far as stuff like refund policies, which is something that Steam actually has done quite well.
That's the big thing that's keeping me from switching over, like the Epic switching over. I'm really burnt out on everybody having their own fucking store and their own launcher. Like, I'm really, it's really old for me. So, like, even with something like, I'm a huge Supergiant fan, but I'm not going to switch stores and you know, go to an early access game and do all that. So that's not in the cards for me as far as what makes sense, because I don't have enough time as it is to play the stuff that I have. And so then having to fuck around with installing something else, like I'm not doing it. So they really need to get parity with Steam, even just basic shit like, oh, well, we updated everything and now it works. Like, I just don't want to deal with that shit anymore. You know, like, ironically, it's easier to play PC games than it is console games these days. And a huge chunk of that is because of Steam. So, yeah, I don't makes me probably sound like an asshole, but I don't care about the developers and how much more money they're going to make over there or anything. What I care about is it does this work for me? And that's probably a dickhead thing to say, but I don't really care.
That's fair.
You know, it's
user-facing stuff is important. Yeah. I mean, you know, and they've just announced that they've got a refund policy now that's on par with Steam's. So they've got that in place. You know, I think maybe the Epic Game Store kind of launched a little too early and a little too half-baked. But it seems like it's starting to flesh out pretty well. Yeah, but you know, whether it rides out the Fortnite fad is another thing.
So. I think it depends on how much market saturation they get from other games by that time.
Yeah.
I only play Falcom games on PC, so.
Well, that's really the best place to play.
Yeah.
You know. Okay, so we got another weird story here. apparently, there's a problem with. There's a game called Improbable, and they've had an issue with Unity.
Well, I can explain this a bit more. So Improbable is a middleware provider for Unity. They make Spatial OS, which is a cloud server platform primarily used for multiplayer stuff. So it's a middleware that a lot of like indie developers can use for multiplayer stuff, which is used for MMO like World's Drift. If you remember that 1,000-player battle royale that was announced at E3, that is using Spatial OS. And so they, the other day, announced that Unity was going to essentially be turning off the compatibility with Spatial OS and essentially force a lot of games to go offline. And Unity is basically saying, no, that's not the case. And so I think Improbable, let's see. Yeah, Unity is saying that Improbable was violating their terms of service and had been for about the past year. knew about it and made no efforts to try and fix the issues they had with them. And so they've had their license with Unity pulled. But Unity is still going to support the games that are working, that are using that for, you know, as long as they're staying on Unity. So it's this weird whole he said, she said thing involving these two companies putting out statements about this thing and let's say two completely different things that kind of makes Improbable look like the one that's at fault here. Mm-hmm. Having known about these issues that Unity had with them as far as their terms were concerned and still did nothing to try and rectify that stuff. And so as a result, Improbable has partnered with Epic to set up a new fund, $25 million, essentially to encourage Spatial OS developers to move off of Unity over to Unreal.
And there's Epic being very aggressive again.
Yeah. Taking any opportunity to try to suggest, hey, you know, fuck Unity. Come over to Unreal. So we're not going to do whatever this issue was. And yeah, it's Epic is definitely getting very aggressive out there, especially just, you know, throw on $25 million. Like it's nothing, because it probably is nothing for them.
Yeah. No, they make,
$25 million in like...
They make $2 million a day profit on Fortnite. $2 million a day. It's
all right, here's a two-week paycheck. All right, guys, come over to Unreal.
Basically.
Just saw some developers just being like, fuck, if Epic just gives me $25 million, I'll do whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, obviously it's not all going to go to one developer, but... Yeah, this is kind of crazy that even Epic is kind of working with middleware to try and discourage people from using Unity in a weird way. It's not really competition. This is kind of conspiring against them in a way.
Yeah, this is something that we really should pay attention to because it could lead to like a monoculture as far as the PC gaming market goes.
Yeah.
And that's never a good thing. But having actually tried to develop in Unity, I can safely say that it is shit. Not that I have strong feelings on the subject or not, but yeah. So what else we got in the? Oh yeah, Steam has fake game restrictions. Oh yeah, they bugged out for actual real indie games.
Yeah, so when games release on Steam, they typically have like a trial period where there are some limitations to the achievements appearing on people's profiles and the ability to get the trading cards and stuff like that.
Oh yeah, this is the anti-Russian card farming algorithm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it apparently bugged out for a number of games, particularly like Wandersong, which is a game that has won awards, has like 100% user reviews on Steam.
Hmm.
So it's not a fake game by any stretch.
Mm-hmm.
And they were posting on Twitter, you know, Wandersong's Steam reviews are so good that Valve doesn't necessarily believe it's a real game and still haven't enabled many basic features for us in case it's a bot trick. But it's real. And then, you know, link to their account, their Steam page. And found out that, yeah, this is happening to a few other games. It started getting reported, and Valve finally got back to the developers who had reported this a few times to them as a bug. And they kept saying, no, this is working as intended. You know, it's a real good developer relations there. They're saying, your game being treated as a fake game, no, that's legit. So you wonder why maybe developers might be looking to other alternatives.
Other storefronts, yeah.
Whether it's Twitch or Epic or, you know, itch.io or GOG, you know, any of these others. Yeah. I think Luca was on here, LUCAH.
Yeah.
Let's see, Piggy Ball was another one. Also had a similar issue. And apparently Valve basically came out and responded, said, oh yeah, this is a bug that it was approved to get switched over to legit game status, but somehow never applied it to the actual page.
Sure.
Yeah. And also in this sort of issue is The Void Reigns Upon Her Heart, which was a game that went early access before this stuff was put into action. So it ended up being a weird case where it didn't put any limits on their achievements, but it had other restrictions because that stuff went in mid-release, early access period. And so it never appears on the store that it's being affected, at least outwardly. So it's really weird situations. Like, yeah, having all these different, like, different things affecting your account seems like it kind of bugs out in weird ways.
Yeah.
Sort of like how on Xbox there's like 3 or 4 different ways you can own a game. And occasionally it doesn't appear. Sometimes it just bugs out and says, oh, you don't own this. And you're like, no, I paid for this, but it's changed status over, you know, over the last few years. Like, oh, it just appears weird. But you can look up your, like, purchase history and be like, no, it's right there.
Yeah, like sometimes you'll see the game like on your on the store page, and it'll say not purchased. But if you go to the bundle, it's purchased there. Yeah. But the standalone doesn't show up. Yeah, it's
like they delisted the standalone edition. Now it's only available in a bundle, which you technically don't own, but also the game itself is saying it's not owned. It's real weird stuff. But yeah, this seems like Valve's getting into those same sort of issues. Where
they got a mess on their hand over there.
Yeah. Seems like a huge web of coding bullshit that's tied into algorithms that occasionally doesn't work.
Yep. All right. So let's start catching up a little bit with what we missed when we were out. Some Stardock stupidity for their Star Control game. Yeah, their DMCA claim kind of got rejected, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the whole thing was there was a dispute between Stardock and the creators of the original Star Control games.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been having a spat for quite a while now, but eventually ended up with Stardock making a new game called Star Control Origins, claiming they owned all the rights and all that. And the original developers that the original creators basically put in DMCA. Take down notice on this game and got that taken care of. So their game, Stardock's game got taken down, and now we've gotten they tried to legally have they put a request for an injunction against this DMC takedown and further ones that the original creators might be putting in. And, yeah, the judge puts down a really great statement, basically telling Stardock that they're the creation of their own problems. Indeed, not only has Stardock CEO Brad Wardell failed to establish any such expertise, but his opinions as to whether the work in question is copyrightable constitutes an improper legal conclusion. Such legal conclusions are without evidentiary value. The conclusion also continues. The plaintiff was aware of defendant's copyright claim to Star Control 1 and 2 since the developments of Origins commenced, however, and was aware of the contours of the present copyright dispute since at least December 2017. Thus, whatever monies plaintiff invested in Origins was done with the knowledge that serious copyright disputes were likely to arise or arisen. So basically, they spent money making this game knowing that there might be not a solid legal foundation to actually make it. In view of the foregoing, the harm plaintiff complains is indeed of their own making. Plaintiff had knowledge of defendant's copyright claims from the outset. Despite that knowledge, it developed potentially infringing material without resolution of the IP ownership issues and publicized the release of that material during the pendency of this action. Now claims that his investment in Origins and reputation are on the line. Given that plaintiff largely created the foregoing predicament, the court is disinclined to extricate plaintiff from a peril of its own making. They said, you did this to yourselves. We're not going to do anything to stop this. Because I guess they only had the rights to Star Control 3.
Yeah.
And the mechanics and such involving that, not the original two games.
Mm-hmm.
And they made a game that was like those original two games that they did not have the rights to. And so, yeah, it's a little bit confusing, but essentially Stardock is stupid, wasted their own money, and are complaining that somehow they should have had the rights to do this, even though they knew they didn't.
You know, none of this surprises me in any way.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, the as far as game publishers go, they're kind of relatively new. Yeah, they used to do, you know, desktop software. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Anyway. God damn it. Apparently, Stardock needs to hire a better legal team to maybe
any legal team.
Maybe one that they will listen to.
Yeah. So, all right. So we're getting on 2 hours. So we'll try to burn through these as quickly as we can for the last few. Quick note: Frank Cifaldi was partially responsible for recovering the SimCity prototype for the NES.
Yep, I'm surprised. This is one of those things I'm wondering. It's like, why did this never get released?
I don't know.
I think it's because they had the Super Nintendo version.
Yep.
They're like, we're not going to put any more time into this NES version to finish it. Even though from what Frank Cifaldi and the people they hired to kind of comb over the code and all that, it has a lot of the same features that the Super Nintendo version has. Mm. It just doesn't look quite as good, and it's obviously not finished. But
Yeah,
so they have a really cool article here just going over the history of the game, a lot of the stuff they learned from going through the code and all that. And you can also find the, I think towards the bottom, the Internet Archive for this game, which has the ROM as well as soundtrack stuff, a commented source disassembly, game soundtrack in MP3 and NSF formats, still images related to games marketing developments, and a game FAQ in PDF format.
Yoink!
Yep, so... you want to try it out for yourself? You can definitely do that in whatever emulator you want to try it out in. And yeah, it's a pretty cool piece of gaming history because I believe they had to spend quite a bit of money just to get the prototype, despite even getting a little discount. Looks like there's two prototypes out there.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
So if you like indie games, Rami Ishmael has you covered. He's got a platform up with a new indie game every day.
Yeah, it's called Meditations.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the thing I did not know when I first installed this is it changes every day. So you get one, it's not a cumulative thing. Maybe by the end it will.
No.
But yeah, so each day it downloads a new game, places the one that you were playing it before. And they got managed to get 365 games from a variety of small teams.
Yeah, for one day at a time.
And I think they've had a little bit of issue with just the way they credit people. I think they're working on getting a site up with all that stuff so people can sort of have proof that they worked on this thing.
Yeah.
As well as all proper credits done. But other than that, it seems like it is a really cool project.
Hmm.
So yeah, if you want to play some indie games, free ones, definitely download the installer and get the clients going for that.
Another installer. But I kind of like the idea, though. It's like you just open it up and there's a new game that you have no idea what it's going to be.
Yep.
It's kind of cool. So, all right, we got some release dates from Nintendo. What do we got here? Yoshi's Crafted World is March 29th. March 8th for Kirby's Extra Epic Yarn.
Yep.
So
it's 3DS for the last one, Switch for the first one. Seems like maybe a direct went got canceled or something like that.
Yeah,
it generally doesn't announce.
Normally doesn't drop dates like this. They normally like just put them in a direct. So
and I think Dragon's Dogma also got announced around the same time for I think April, but also these ports of Final Fantasy 12 and 10-10-2. Also got dates around the same time.
So we got that going. Yeah. Final Fantasy games coming to Xbox One and Switch, it looks like.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
12 is on April 30th, and 10 and 10-2 is April 16th.
All right.
Yep. Makes me wonder, any of you guys interested in having Final Fantasy games on your Switch?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Okay.
I already have them on other platforms. I don't need to double dip.
Yeah, me too.
But see, the thing is with this is you'll be able to play them on the go. So
yeah,
I don't take my Switch anywhere. It stays within about 10 feet of my room.
Yeah. So what else we got going on here? The online, the NES stuff that came out for Switch this month was actually a little less great over here than it was in Japan. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Two games they added this month were Zelda 2 and Blaster Master.
Both of which are good games in their own right.
Yeah, but usually there's three games every month.
Yeah.
It's missing Joy Mecha Fight, which was released on the Japanese version of the app, which means if you already have a paid subscription for Nintendo Switch Online, you can create a quick Japanese account if you don't already have it.
Get the
NES app there and just load it up on your US account.
Yeah. Give it a shot, dude.
What that is, so...
Yeah, the weird thing is, I don't know why they don't just put it on the NES, the Western apps, and because say, hey, this is a Japanese game.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, because they think they'd probably have to translate it first.
Yeah, I mean, I could just
they didn't do it on a virtual console.
That's true.
Yeah, this is a Japanese game. It might be hard to read what's going on, but you may still find some cool stuff here.
Yeah.
Especially being an NES game, Nintendo game.
They totally should do that because, I mean, completely honestly, the Famicom's, like, entire library, like, it dwarfs what we got here in the U.S. and the rest of the world. Yeah. So,
yeah, especially if they're going to actually dip into those Japanese-only releases.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the Switch Online, this whole, drip feed of NES games is... It's not very satisfying.
No.
I don't think they're handling that very well, to be brutally honest. Although, according to data miners, you might see some SNES games showing up soon. So
that would be a market improvement.
Yep.
Yeah.
SNES.
Yep. No SNES.
God damn it.
All right, are we going to rehash this argument again?
Yeah, I don't know what you guys were talking about. I always just called it Super Nintendo, so...
Right. Yeah. Well, the Super Nintendo, the data miners had found listed games, but they also found some other emulators that are under code name.
Yep.
We don't know what those are exactly yet, but we can take guesses. It's not the NES. It's not the SNES. It's something else Nintendo worked on, or perhaps maybe something. Like TurboGrafx, like we saw on the virtual console, would be extremely exciting.
Yeah.
And welcome.
We don't know.
Find it being a Genesis, so we can use some of those new Sega controllers from CES.
Hell yeah.
I mean, and that would be a good, you know, they've shown this before, like I say, with the virtual console. They've shown that they are, you know, open to working with companies like Sega or TurboGrafx, you know, so.
Yeah, like the last... Like, most of the games that came out for the Wii U over the last, like, year or two have been TurboGrafx 16 games from Konami. That's, like, it's a very weird thing to realize.
Yeah. So. But, yeah. And the last bit of news that we'll get to before we get our picks of the week and wrap the show up is that Nintendo has officially confirmed that Bowsette cannot be canon. Stop pestering us.
This is a joy I can only feel when a meme dies. If it could take Ugandan Knuckles and the Waluigi for Smash thing with it, I would be even happier, but...
Yeah. Not that you have strong feelings on the subject or anything, Pat, but... Yeah. Yeah, so this is something that kind of blew up before the release of Smash and then just kind of kept going, so much so that a lot of people thought maybe they were actually going to do it. No. And again, no.
April, and that's the entire beef that I have with memes, because meme culture just takes a subpar joke and drills it into the ground until you're sick of it, and that's my entire... beef with the idea. So
you will live on forever in our hearts
and Pornhub.
No,
my
sure.
Colon.
No. Yeah. So you have any feelings on this, Ryan, before we wrap up here?
No, I'm sorry.
that's about all we need.
I kind of missed it.
Yeah, you didn't miss much. Trust me. All right, so we'll get to our picks of the week, and to kind of put a bow on what I was talking about earlier this episode, my pick is the ABOX Raspberry Pi 3 B Plus Starter Kits. If you're looking to get into Pi for either RetroPie or other projects that you might want to do, like, you know, media centers or stuff like that, this is actually a pretty good way to go. You get pretty much everything you need, apart from, you know, a monitor and a keyboard, but, you know, you probably have those lying around anyway. It's a nice little kit. The price is quite good. It comes very nicely packaged with instructions and everything on how to get going. The one thing knock that I would say is that it comes with a USB Type-C card reader for the micro SD. That's a little bit irritating because I don't have a USB-C port on my motherboard, so I can't use that. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, I had a card reader anyway, so that's not that huge of a deal. But still, if this is something you're aiming for the general consumer, you really should make it a Type-A card reader if that's something you're going to include, because everybody's got those ports. Mm-hmm. That's my pick. What about you, Brandon?
My pick is, if you get a chance to play the one-shot demo for the Resident Evil 2 remake. Like I said earlier, what it is it's a game. It's a demo. It gives you a 30-minute time limit. You can only do it once. Of course, if you've also got multiple accounts, you can probably do it again and again. But basically, it plops you in the middle. You're playing Leon Kennedy, and it's, I believe, in the section where you're already inside the police station. And it gives you sort of a good idea of sort of like how this particular iteration of Resident Evil 2 plays, how it affects how you go about it. Basically, what it is it's still very much sort of, you know, the overall story and structure of the original Resident Evil 2. But basically, after that, but the gameplay, the actual like meat and gameplay, is very much in the style of Resident Evil 4. Which is, it's that over the shoulder type that Resident Evil 4 did, but don't think that in any way lessens the effects, because they did a really good job going back over and redoing all of the graphics from the ground up. Because, you know, if you thought the original Resident Evil 2 was gross and gruesome, it ain't got nothing on the remake. They made a really good job of making all the gross, crushed, meaty bits being all nice and shiny and juicy for you. Don't think it lessens the scares either, because holy crap, these zombies do not screw around, and they're also surprisingly quiet. They can sneak up on you without you realizing it. And you'll just suddenly hear that groan behind you, like, holy shit, they're right there. If you get the chance, go give it a shot. I managed to finish it in about 20 minutes, but like I said, it's a hard 30. Also, if you haven't noticed, check out the latest trailer, because they gave us a shot of what, like, Hunk and Tofu are going to look like. You guys know who Hunk and Tofu are, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, Hunk, and those were like the sort of secret side campaigns you could do for Resident Evil 2. One is playing Hunk, who's like a member of Umbrella's first PMC group. And then there's Tofu, who's literally a giant walking hunk of tofu with a police hat on. And speaks in Japanese.
Okay.
That's all I got.
Yeah. All right. And I saw that Ryan is saying he's giving a thumbs up on also the Resident Evil 2 demo, so that's cool.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't sure if I wanted to play the Resident Evil 2 demo, or if it was going to be like a kind of a, like a standalone thing or part of the game. Resident Evil 2 is one of my, I mean, it's probably, if I was to sit down and actually make a top 10 list, it's in there, I would think. So I'm really looking forward to this one, and everything I've seen looks like they they've really taken the time to do it so well, that I was kind of thinking I didn't want to do the demo and I just wanted to play the game when it came out. Cause we're only a couple weeks. I want to say it's coming out end of the month, right?
It comes out on the 25th.
Yeah. But the more I hear you talk about it, I think I'm going to play it tonight for the demo. So, that's going to be my, my pick. Definitely.
Cool. All right. So Dan Rub, what do you got?
Yeah. I mentioned it last week, but I'm going to go ahead and say it again. For those of you that have Netflix, check out High Score Girl. It's an anime, which is pretty much a romantic comedy. And basically, it's about this guy who's a hardcore arcade enthusiast, big Street Fighter II player. And he's really good. And all of a sudden, he gets his ass kicked by this girl. And he finds out she goes to his school and things like that. Eventually, over the course of the story, he begins to, get feelings for her, and she moves away. So that's all I'm going to say about that. But what really sets this anime apart from anything else I've ever watched is that they really go over the history of gaming from the late 80s to the mid 90s extremely accurately. The main character even, like, fanboys over the TurboGrafx-16 over the Super Nintendo, which I thought was absolutely hilarious. And it even goes over like some arcade strategies that like I never really knew. Like apparently when you're playing Final Fight and you're trying to like get items out of crates and stuff, if you press some buttons at the right time, you'll get gems instead, so you can go for a higher score and things like that. And all this stuff was real, and I was just overly impressed. Apparently Square Enix is one of the companies that distributes this anime in Japan, and that's how they were able to get like all this footage and stuff, and it's really impressive. It also ends in a hell of a cliffhanger that will make you want to hate yourself. So yeah,
yeah. All right. Chris, yeah, let's bring us home.
So there is the huge holiday sale that's been going on at PSN for about the last month or so. It ends on Tuesday. There's lots of good deals in there. I'm not going to go through. And then because it's like 1,500 items, it's ridiculous. Yeah. But definitely, if you've missed stuff that's recent from the last year or so, or there's a bunch of older stuff that is on some pretty good prices, like the God of War collection on PS3 and Vita, the first two games, it's like $2. If you have PS Plus, I think it's cross-buy, so you can get it on either platform. God of War 3 Remastered is like $3. There's some great prices there. So if you want to bury yourself in games before 2019 buries you, it's a good way to do that.
Yep.
That's true.
Yeah, if you haven't subscribed to the show, I'd like to remind you to do so. You can do so on iTunes, Google Play, TuneIn, or your favorite podcast aggregator. You can also check us out at smashpad.com, where we have a lot of our written content there, and expect some changes and stuff happening in 2019 here. So with that, I have been Filippo D'Anolfo, and for Patrick Mifflin, Crystal OG, Denver Victorio, Lee Lamb, and Ryan Schlemmer, and Brandon Perkins, I'd like to say see you next week.